Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian, your regular guide to what's hot, what's not, and what's utter rot in the world of technology, high and low. From San Francisco, my name's Bobby Johnson, and once again I'm standing in for Alex Kratosky while she slaves away over her PhD thesis as the long struggle to become Dr. Kratosky comes to a close. Seriously, if you take a look at her Flickr photo stream, the pain will become immediately apparent. Anyway, since I'm in the hot seat this week, I thought we should catch up with some of the interesting people you can meet here in the heartland of the high-tech industry, including one man who's attempting to turn the entire web into your playground, and another who wants to take online maps to the next level. On top of that, we'll be hearing the latest news, catching up with your comments from the blog, and getting into the lift with another unsuspecting entrepreneur as we welcome back our regular elevator pitch feature. Now, if that sounds like your cup of Darjeeling, then you're in the right place. So get ready to turn on, tune in, and grok out. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. We're going to start the show this week by hearing from Justin Hall, the chief executive of online gaming company GameLayers, and a famous face on the web scene over the past few years. In fact, since it kicked into life in the early 90s, Justin has been intimately involved with the web, first as a staffer at Hotwired, then a writer on the games industry, and as one of the very first bloggers. Now he's doing something rather different, with GameLayers, a company that wants to turn the whole web into a space for you to play in. Their first game, a browser-based steampunk adventure called The Nethernet, has been improving rapidly in recent months, so I grabbed my microphone and went to catch up with Justin here in San Francisco, and started by asking him to give me a little more detail on what the Nethernet actually is.
There are tens of millions or more people who are all plugged into the same internet. I mean, if you think about it, when we are in our web browsers, we are sharing a network space together. So GameLayers is a company founded on making games that happen in that shared network space. And we said, oh man, there are such elaborate and exciting multiplayer online fantasies that you can enter, but I'm already on my computer for 8 hours a day working. Well, why don't I get points and levels and all those things inside my browser as I'm just leading my online life? So our first project we called a passively multiplayer online game because we wanted you to be able to play it in the background as you were going about other activities. So The Nethernet today is such a game. It's a Firefox toolbar. If you run the Firefox web browser, you install this toolbar, and then as you surf, you find treasures and traps that are buried in websites, and you stumble upon missions that other people made that link you from website to website with their own annotations on top, and at the end might be a prize or some punishment from them. So these are the sorts of experiences that we want to help users create to allow people to see the internet as a vast playfield where everyone's a potential mate to play.
So as I'm playing Nethernet, which runs in my browser, it's fully self-contained in there. I can bomb my friends or my enemies and, you know, blow them to smithereens or set a trap for them on Facebook or something so that when they arrive at that page, they will interact with the kind of Easter eggs that I've left there. Is that right?
That's correct. Our game is about user-generated content. So it's about going out on the web and discovering that, wow, there's an entirely passionate community of people who really dislike a certain size of dog. And if you are just happening to be researching that dog, your browser will be shaking, bombs will be going off, and you will be called to action to defend those small dogs against the people who don't like them. And the tools are there for you to wage information warfare on, to defend the ideas you believe in, to protect order and beauty on the internet, or to promote chaos and disruption and distraction for other people.
So I'm imagining a kind of organized 4chan, basically, in a way, where you are pitting these forces of weirdness against each other in a fight that, you know, I suppose resembles something like World of Warcraft or whatever. You know, they're pitching into battle against each other. Doesn't it get a bit invasive though? If I'm, you know, slyly trying to do some playing while I'm at work, and suddenly my browser starts going like woo 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 and exploding, won't it get in the way a little bit?
Yes, you should protect yourself while you surf by wearing your armor. And if you're wearing armor, then your browser doesn't shake when you stumble across the bombs. So what we've tried to do is to build these tools that all speak to each other. So if you're like, oh man, I'm surfing the internet for research, you put on your armor because you want to be protected from the crazy wild internet. And when you say, man, I'm out there to make money and have fun and go crazy, you take off your armor and you run on the internet unprotected.
There's a lesson there, I'm sure. The we've heard a lot about, you know, massively multiplayer online gaming. There's a lot of stuff going on about pervasive gaming, where, you know, you turn the world around you, in the real physical world, into a kind of a game space. This though is kind of somewhere in between, isn't it? It's a game that happens as a layer over what you're already doing. Are you the only people doing this? Is there a movement of people kind of creating these Firefox browser add-on games in other places?
There's a fantastic range of games that are being made using data, because if you look around us, we are constantly sloughing off tons of data. I mean, our phones know where we are, our computers know who we chat with. These are fantastic fertile fields of play, and there are many people beginning to harvest them to make interesting game experiences that are somewhere between the totally immersive fake worlds of MMOs and then the arrestingly real, you must drop everything of what you're doing and answer this payphone kind of alternate reality game scenario.
You could obviously kind of re-flash the game to make it, I don't know, like a gangster game, or, you know, or a futuristic space shoot 'em up or whatever. You could kind of rebadge it. Have you got any visions of where, you know, in 5 years there might be something else going on, extra data you can use, extra information that you can put into the game?
We have a record of where people like to leave bombs and where people like to leave treasure. So if as a company we had 16 different skins, you know, ones for people who love cats and ones for people who love burly men with cigars and ones for people who love soldiers, and all those people are playing, the question I wonder is, would you want all of them feeding the same data pool so that what looks like a mine to you, the soldier, looks like a pile of cat puke to the cat fan, and all these things are left on different websites, but they're all part of the same data that says this is good, this is bad? Because one thing that I really dislike about contemporary massively multiplayer online games is if you say, man, I'm playing this hot new game, come join me, it's going to be very hard for me to find you, to arrange to play with you at the same time. And what I really want to see is giant games across all of information space that bring us together, that we can all play together. So if we have all these different themed games, how can we make sure that people are still able to play across generations, across tastes? I don't know that Game Layers has solved that problem yet, but I think that's a wonderful problem for the world to work on.
Some of the funding you got from in the first instance was from the UK, and you got started off with kind of BBC projects and things like that. How are you finding it now? You know, the financial pressures are growing, and people are worried about how you make money. What do you tell your investors?
So we did get our start at Game Layers building a game to teach web literacy for the BBC. So the story has changed over time from, we are going to turn all of our players into more literate web citizens who will better discourse on the internet, to, we have compelling, engaging game dynamics that will help people find community and become attached to our unique universe that will then be worth them spending money on. So we had a sort of a run on our merchandise this weekend. We sold a ton of t-shirts and mugs and stickers and mouse pads and things, which is fantastic, because we finally realized that the mugs and stickers and t-shirts and mouse pads that the community in the Nethernet wanted to buy are all created by the community. So we finally let the community put their slogans on the t-shirts and their jokes on the mugs, and now they're selling really well. So I think what's exciting for me and what I can tell our investors is there's a path to money in the product we have, and the path is through an engaged community of people who are passionate about the product and care enough that they will spend money because they see that spending money leads to this fantastic game and this great user community that they enjoy being a part of.
Justin Hall of Game Layers. And if that's tickled your taste buds, you can find out more about the Nethernet by visiting thenethernet.com. Now, for a change of pace, it's time to hear about this week's news headlines.
The Business Secretary, Lord Mandelson, has proposed new measures to combat piracy in Britain, including cutting off alleged file sharers. The ideas, which come in the wake of a series of other consultations and proposals, are likely to be announced in the Queen's speech. But they drew fire when they emerged shortly after Mandelson had spent time with the record industry mogul David Geffen on his luxury yacht. The English version of Wikipedia broke the 3 million articles barrier this week, giving a brief spotlight to Norwegian soap star Beat Eriksson, who was the subject of the article in question. Microsoft has questioned the claims by its web browser rival Firefox that it's been downloaded a billion times. Senior Microsoft executive Amy Bars-Dukas told The Guardian that the recent announcement was interesting math and that she encourages people to be somewhat sceptical of the numbers. And Samsung and Orange have announced plans to launch Britain's first phone with predictive text in Welsh. Users will be able to send their friends messages telling them off the Neil, that's OMG to you and me, from September the 1st, although whether they'll be Quirthin in Uckle, that's LOLing, remains to be seen.
Thanks for that, and if you want more details on these stories and all the up-to-date headlines on the technology world, then just go to guardian.co.uk/technology for more. Now, I'll admit it's been a little while since we dragged somebody into the lift to take part in our elevator pitch, not least because our very own Jemima Kish has been very busy with her own side project, who goes by the name of Artly. You might remember hearing from the little guy a couple of weeks ago. That hasn't stopped Jemima from moonlighting as the voice of the elevator once more, as we take another unsuspecting entrepreneur and grill them about their startup. So, let's see who we've got in the lift this week.
Welcome to the elevator pitch.
Ground floor. Please mind the doors.
Which floor?
I'll have floor 7 for live music, please.
Going up.
So, who are you? And what's your company called?
I'm James Proud and I'm the co-founder and developer and designer of giglocator.com.
Okay, so explain your business to me in a nutshell.
There's a lot of sites out there that help you to discover live music and keep up to date with your live music, but we don't think that they really encompass the whole thing about getting recommendations to people who maybe don't go to live music and might want to. Basically, you simply sign up and you can sync with your Last.fm and we learn what you like and we're able to track but also make really accurate recommendations like Last.fm do to the things you like, and it's all location based and you can go to multiple locations.
First floor.
And tell me about your background.
I'm a student at the moment and I've always been involved in web development, that sort of thing, but this is my first true venture into an actual startup.
And this makes money how?
Miles has done a good job in getting quite a good commission off the ticket providers, so we are able to make quite a good markup on the ticket price that is sold.
Second floor.
So what's your biggest challenge?
Our biggest challenge is getting the user base primarily, and of course hopefully being able to scale with that, but we think the service appeals to those who don't go to gigs and those who do, so we think we might have a good chance.
And if you had £10 million to invest in any company other than your own, what would you invest in?
Well, definitely Spotify. It's basically stop pirating with them, because you don't need to pirate anymore if you can just go straight to Spotify. And I think that's the answer for the music industry at the moment. They're doing the best in leading that way.
Third floor.
Who's your competition?
Songkick are a great London startup and they're doing quite a lot, especially they're getting quite a lot of press at the moment. But there's also Gig Junkies, and I also think that Last.fm are doing a good thing with their events. They just would need to focus a bit more on that, but their main audience is for the music and not the events.
What's the most important piece of software or web tool that you use every day?
Amazon Web Services helps us tremendously, because we, instead of having to have all the images and that sort of stuff on the site, we can now offload them to content distribution, and that's helped us keep the cost down phenomenally.
Fourth floor.
So where do you want to be in 5 years' time?
We'd hopefully like to be the Facebook-esque type location for gigs, so instead of when someone posts on their Twitter or on their blog saying that they're going to this and then they put the Ticketmaster or CTicketCRO, we'd like them to put the gig locator thing, and I think that'd be the end goal.
Fifth floor. Doors opening.
In the lift this week, that was James Proud of giglocator.com. Now, while we're out and about here in San Francisco, I thought I'd squeeze in another interview, this time with Michael Magurski, who is a partner at a design and technology consultancy here in the city called Stamen. Now, you may have heard of them. The company works on web projects with organisations like the London Olympics and Dig.com. But alongside his day job, Mike's one of the world's foremost experts on web cartography, and he's heavily involved in the OpenStreetMap project to create freely available maps of the entire planet. In fact, he's such a fan that he's trying to expand the use of OpenStreetMap in, well, a rather unusual direction. So, when I caught up with him at Stamen's offices, I asked him to start by explaining a project he's working on called Walking Papers.
You can imagine that when OpenStreetMap was first starting up, they had this kind of cold start problem where they have, you know, a big empty map and no data on it. And so the trick at that point, you know, 4 years ago, is to get out your GPS unit and walk every single street and figure out exactly where on earth those streets are located. Now, in 2009, we're sort of in this much more advanced situation where you've got countries like the UK where pretty much every street is roughly in place. You've got countries like the United States where massive data imports from the US Census have made it possible to also have pretty much every street in place. And so where OpenStreetMap is trying to go to from there is to figure out what's happening between all those streets. So parks, buildings, bus stops. And when you look at something like Google Maps, that's things you search for that appear in front of the map. But I think OpenStreetMap is starting to think about that stuff as information that's kind of baked into the map. So the idea with Walking Papers is to take advantage of the fact that most of the streets tend to be there, and it's difficult to like copy in the location of a cafe from an aerial photo if you don't know it's there. So the way the project works is that you print out maps based on OpenStreetMap of a given area. You draw on them, so you walk around the streets and you mark off, you know, X marks the cash machines, and you know, the little circle is for all the cafes, and then I see this address point. And you basically mark things that you see kind of around you at eye level. And then what the project does is it allows you to scan those sheets of paper back in, and it automatically recognizes where in the world they came from, and a process called georectification that then makes it possible for you to trace over that stuff.
What's your ambition in helping that, and what do you think the long-term consequences are of you know, creating this open source version of mapping? I mean, it can reduce cost, or it allows people to play with information in a way they haven't before. But is it all going somewhere, or is it just an exciting experiment at the moment?
I think it's a big, exciting experiment that's going places. It allows a new kind of person to be involved in the kind of culture creation of cartography. That's a term that I'm sort of borrowing from friends of ours in the UK called Schultz and Webb, that do a lot of thinking around, you know, technology and culture and product and, you know, data from people and so on. And I think that with mapping, it's a really important kind of piece of information to have out in the world. You know, partially it's just costs. It means that more different kinds of people can make maps where before they might have to, you know, scan, borrow, or steal whatever they have. I think there's a lot of worth in being able to create your own maps that foreground and background different things. You know, there's this kind of de facto situation on the web right now, which is, you know, Google Maps or Microsoft Maps or Yahoo Maps that were all designed with a really simple kind of wayfinding in mind. And I think what OpenStreetMap is doing is by opening up the vector data and making it possible for more different kinds of weird nerds and experimenters to work with this stuff, it means that entirely new kinds of activities can be opened up. So you've got, you know, Brandon Anderson up in the Pacific Northwest here in the US, who's doing kind of shortest path trees, where he's doing renderings of cities that show, you know, what the fastest way is to get from one place to another, you know, for all possible pathways as opposed to just the one you want. You've got people in the UK like mysociety.org that are doing projects that have to do with, you know, similar kinds of ideas, but around like housing prices and travel times and commute times and how nice different places are and so on. And they're all able to take advantage of these kinds of open geodata to make it possible to show pictures that wouldn't otherwise be possible.
So we've talked a lot about the exciting possibilities for mapping and what you can do with map data. You guys have really been the pioneers of turning all of those ideas into real live things that people can use.
We're living in a really beautiful time when cartography and map making is starting to become accessible to regular people. The map is becoming available for reuse and reinterpretation. I think that process began kind of in earnest in 2004 with the publication of Google Maps and with the publication of the O'Reilly book Mapping Hacks. You know, on the one hand, the book kind of exposed all the technology available to people. On the other hand, Google Maps exposed kind of the desire and the possibilities associated with that stuff. So like crime mapping, for example, kind of became a capital T thing on the internet approximately at the time that Adrian Holovaty began to scrape addresses from the Chicago crime or the Chicago police website and applied it to Google Maps and kind of, you know, made sort of one of those first kind of canonical mashups. What we're doing is we're kind of making it possible for people to subscribe to alerts and, you know, search on different areas and see what happens at different times of day and, you know, really kind of slice and dice that data in ways that are more useful than just dots on a map. The other kind of side of what we're seeing is that the vector data of the base map is starting to become available. So England or the UK has this sort of interesting licensing landscape with this stuff where you've got the Ordnance Survey essentially asserting copyright over map data for an entire country. And what that's led to is a kind of backlash in the form of projects like OpenStreetMap.org, where they're trying to take all of this cartographic data and kind of recreate it from scratch in a way that makes it possible to use it without having to incur licensing and cost. So we're really able to use that for projects like crime spotting, where you can take all of this kind of cartographic information and reinterpret it visually and explore what that looks like without necessarily just kind of eating what Google or Microsoft or Yahoo gives you in terms of base map.
Mike McGursky of Stamen Design there, and if you want to try contributing to OpenStreetMap using Walking Papers, then just visit the site at walking-papers.org. That's pretty much all we've got time for this week, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. I just wanted to give a shout out to those who commented on last week's episode. Not least Master Is Love, who responded to our interview with NVIDIA boss Jensen Huang by suggesting that it was all Apple's idea. And I quote, "Once again, Apple is the little light in the darkness." Now that little light might be a little strong, but we're always happy to receive your comments and questions about the show. In fact, I'm also going to say hello to listeners Toby Tickle, Sean Tollerton and Drunken Oaf, who recently left reviews about the show on the iTunes store. And they said a number of lovely things about us, including calling us not boring, which I think is an achievement in itself. And if you want to get in touch, then just drop onto the blog. You can say something on our Facebook wall or ping us via Twitter. All the links are there for you at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Other than that, all that's left is for me to thank our guests, Justin Hall, Michael McGursky and James Proud. This week's producer, as always, was the unstoppable Scott Corley, and I'm Bobby Johnson. See you next Tuesday.